Welcome to Virtual Realities, a podcast that focuses on VR games, presented by the Gamerheads Podcast. I am your host, Roger, and my guest this week is Dave Proctor. He is a director at Mighty Yell, and he has worked on The Big Con and most recently, a game that we're going to be talking about today, A Night in the Attic. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Roger. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for taking time out of your schedule to meet with me. I got a chance to play A Night in the Attic. I reviewed it. I loved it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Before we get into the game, though, I want to talk about yourself.
Sure.
Have a couple questions here for you. First of all, how did you get into the world of video games? Like, what made you decide this is what I want to do with my life when I grow up? And then talk about your role as a director and that path that you took to get to that role as well.
It's a fun question because I mean I wanted to make video games when I was 10.
Oh really?
Because I played a lot of Mortal Kombat 2 with my buddy Tom, and we were like, we should make a fighting game, and I like drew all these characters and like we had move sets and all this stuff, and he could program and I could I could like write down ideas, which is a disturbing trend in my career. But I don't know. I was told then that it wasn't like possible. I was told that I couldn't do it. So spite, I think, is the answer to the ultimate outcome here. But I, you know, when I was older, I ended up with, I wanted to be a writer. I was working a lot to being novelist and I played Alan Wake.
Oh, nice.
And it, I was like, I wonder if any, the writing in it is really good. And especially like the fiction writing in the pages that you pick up. And I was like, I wonder if anybody gets paid to do this. And I was like, oh, shoot. I've wasted all this time. I should have been doing this whole time. So that's how I got started. And I mean, I like shortly after went to game design school at George Brown College here in Toronto. And I met, my brothers in arms at 13AM Games. We founded a company. We founded 13AM, and I left there in 2017 and started Mighty Yell.
Nice.
So, like my journey to becoming the like sole, director of the company is that it started as a 10-year-old drawing Mortal Kombat knockoffs and doing a bad job at it.
I was going to ask, are you ever going to go back to though and say like, let's resurrect these characters. Let's make this a thing.
I don't think there's anything there to resurrect. I think there's very clearly like the Sub-Zero character and very clearly the Kano character. And like, I think it was maybe an idea that doesn't need the oxygen right now. And I mean, at Mighty Yell, we focus on like non or anti-violent games in general. Like I love fighting games so much. But it's not the kind of stuff that we are focused on making. So, I gotta send a letter of rejection to that 10-year-old kid. Actually, wait, I gotta tell you a story now real quick. My journey started even younger. I think at 9, when I was playing Mortal Kombat 2, before we started designing this game, I sent, a letter to Acclaim being like, Kintaro should be a playable character in Mortal Kombat 3. I have drawn some fatalities for you. And I wish I had this. But they sent me a letter back and they said, we already have plans for Mortal Kombat 3. Wow. Best of luck in your future endeavors. Thanks a lot for reaching out.
Wow.
And I had this letter from Acclaim. I wish I like, it's the saddest thing in the world. I don't have it anymore. So that's the journey. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with one gentle rejection from Acclaim.
Wouldn't that be great if you could write back now? I mean, obviously that wouldn't work, but if you could say, hey, guess what? I did make it. Thank you so much.
Yeah. These are my future endeavors. Thank you for the wishes of luck. I appreciate you very much. I do think that I like know enough people in the industry and I'm connected enough that I could probably like put out feelers to be like, who would have written this letter? I just want to like meet that person.
I did it.
Just want to say thanks. Like you wrote back to a 9-year-old kid and like didn't call him an idiot. Like, thank you so
much. That's right. You started this. You started this path. So thank you.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's really cool. It's funny that you say that because my friend and I, we used to draw video games too. And I think I'm I'm probably older than you because we were building games when there was shovelware and or sure. shareware, right?
But I was like I'm from shareware.
Okay.
I know shareware.
All right. And and I'll never forget this. Like we're in eighth grade and we're building, you know, silly games, and one was a slot machine, and this guy called our company. We had a company, right? And they called my friend's house, and his mom answered, and she was like, guys, you need to stop this. This is like, you can't have weird people calling me at the middle of the night saying, I can't get this game to work. So that ended my career in that as a game designer. So,
oh, I mean, hey, it's never too late. I'm living proof.
Oh, that's a great story. Thank you for that. Speaking of stories, since we're talking about A Night in the Attic, what's the game about? What's the story behind this game?
Yeah. I mean, the game is about, and the story behind are like two different things. the game is about, I mean, you, as every good VR game is, except Moss, which is really good. But like you are in your grandma's attic. You start off the game by, you know, pulling the ladder down and getting up there, and you find this magical labyrinth board. Mm. If you know, our listeners at home, don't know what I'm talking about. It's this old sort of puzzle contraption. You would roll a marble around and try to guide it around like holes and get it to a goal. And it's like a little maze challenge. And as you unpack a box and you find the labyrinth board and you find this little figurine and you put her on there and you tilt the board around. And then as you kind of tilt off the board, you discover that you're actually in this big fantasy world, this whole magical world rolls along the board in front of you. And you know, what you've discovered is that you found Guinevere, you found a miniature Camelot, and you are trying to save the world from, you know, the kingdom from the grip of the evil Mordred. So the, you know, the story is Guinevere's story, but it's also kind of a little bit about the stuff that happened before. And it's a little bit about what's happening in the attic as well.
Nice. And we'll get into this a little bit later, but I think one of the things that I really, well, maybe I'll just ask this question now. One of the things I liked about this game is the fact that there is the overall arching story of Guinevere, right? And like she is finding out what happened to King Arthur and Camelot and such. But then there's also this underlying story about the grandmother, right? Because you're looking through the journal and you're paging through the journals and you see these drawings. And it's almost like there's two stories going on there. I guess my question is, was that intentional, first of all? And secondly, was it difficult to try to think of like actually two stories happening kind of simultaneously? One is the obvious one with Guinevere, but then there's the undertow one as well that's more about discovering the attic and finding this toy that your grandmother had.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely intentional. Thank you. And thank you very much for noticing it, because we put a lot of effort into this part, right? Like and you know, the way that I view it is that the player is actually experiencing three stories. So you're experiencing Guinevere's sort of linear story in the moment of, hey, you know, she's rolling across the hills of Camelot. She's talking to Lancelot. The Lady of the Lake is trying to like coax her on a little bit. And along the way you are unlocking, you know, elements in your grandmother's notebook. Mm-hmm. And they give you some tutorials, but they also show you these little drawings of like your grandmother that your grandmother drew. And so you're learning that story as well, but you're also, if you do the kind of off path collectibles, you're also picking up these scrolls, and they are telling a third layer that is sort of the story that led up to and sort of overlaps with Gwen's story.
Yeah.
I had a lot of fun writing those. That was like the one thing that I was sort of in charge of was writing these little moments here. Versus like the amazing gameplay and technical achievement and visual achievement that this game is that you know I got to just be witness to. But I you know, we really wanted we wanted something that kind of evokes that sense of being and discovering something as a kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, thinking about like stories like the Neverending Story or Labyrinth, right? Like stories that make you feel kind of lost in a world of wonder and stumbling upon things. And this sort of, we're going to unlock new elements of the story. We're also going to unlock new elements of the backstory. Like that is that level of discovery that I think works really well in this game. I think it works really well in a lot of games, but I love that idea of like running three stories and having them all dovetail sort of at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that too. And I loved in the, like you said, the journal like acts as a tutorial for you, but also there's elements where, you know, you get the sense that the grandmother was kind of like a little bit of a rebel, right? Like the mom at one scene is like yelling at her for pouring water on things, right? Like I loved that. I loved that so much. And that she also has an airplane, you know, pilot's helmet on, right? Like she dreams big, right? And you get the sense that like you're discovering, as you as a player, discovering more about this grandmother, you know, the character's grandmother, you as playing this character, learning about your grandmother and who she was too. So like there's that connection there. I really liked that.
Yeah, we really wanted to, I mean, the themes of the story are really about perseverance and like, you know, what perseverance means in a, I guess in a non-cartoony context, right? Like it's a thing that comes up in a lot of Disney films and stuff like that. But, you know, you can have this kind of traditional story of perseverance, but also, you know, Guinevere is very like matter of fact. She's very like, well, this is just what I believe I can do.
Yeah.
And I think it's a refreshing take on it rather than like, I must do this. I have to. She's just doing her thing.
Yeah.
She's like this very level-headed person. And we wanted to kind of reflect that in the grandmother a little bit, like who is this person and how does she follow her dream to, you know, hopefully, everybody will get to see the sort of last shot in the journal where, you know, you kind of see how things shake out for her.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that.
Thank you.
Speaking of which, so your previous game, The Big Con, was very, you know, story driven, right? And but it was also different because it was a platform game on a console, right? And this is a VR game. This is your second game. What made you decide to pursue a VR game as your next game? Because that seems so challenging and so different than The Big Con.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's maybe not the decision that every company would make. Maybe some people would like stick to things that they know. And like, that's real valid. I applaud those people. But I don't know. The answer to your question is also reflected in the inverse question where people ask me like, are you guys a VR only studio now?
Mm.
And the answer is like, no, absolutely not. Like we just want to make the right game that challenges us and we think is like interesting enough. I use the word weird a lot when I talk about our games. Like I want our games to always kind of have something a little bit off kilter about how you interact with them or what they're trying to do. And when, you know, when George and Andrea, our creative directors on the project, like, showed this idea with me and we started talking about actually making it, I was like, that's the vibe. That's it. That's the thing. Like it's not just a VR game. It's a VR game that can be played comfortably, that can, you know, you can sit, you can interact with the world in a way that I don't think I've ever seen before.
Yeah.
I still haven't seen, right? Yeah. Like, we follow the sort of, I don't want to use the word innovation, like saying like we are champions of innovation, but like we follow where the strange ideas are. That's always going to be the right call for us.
Nice. Yeah. That's one thing I really loved about A Night in the Attic is the fact that you can just sit down and play the puzzle game and it is nice. And it's like, you know, in a lot of, I shouldn't say all VR games, but a lot of VR games, you know, like I tend to run into things because I'm like, oh, oops, there's a wall there. I shouldn't have walked into that wall, right? But here, like, I loved the fact that I could sit down and I didn't get motion sickness and I was able to play the game. And you know, just a couple hours later, I'm like, oh my goodness. Like, I didn't realize I was spending this much time in the game because it feels cozy and it feels good.
I love that. We, you know, we worked really hard on like comfort, like, you know, thinking about kind of like a comfortable, stress-free VR experience. That was like core from the creative direction to our UX director's wants to the way that our tech team kind of, you know, made the game feel really good and seamless. Like everything about it is meant to make you feel like you can approach it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm never going to go out there and say that, hey, you know, listener with motion sickness, you will 100% not have motion sickness in this game, or your money back, you know, like I'm not going to do that. Especially that last part. But I do think that like, if you've had issues kind of situating your body in VR before, I think Night in the Attic is a great way to kind of start that.
Yeah.
Feeling a bit more comfortable doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. So speaking of the Big Con, was there anything that you learned from the development or design of the Big Con that you applied to a Night in the Attic?
Oh, so much. So much that we learned from our first game and all of the mistakes that we made. But like, you know, we made the Big Con really kind of fluidly. We didn't fully know how our core systems would work and the core design of every level. Like, it's a big open-ended kind of game. So we kind of built tools that could accommodate anything. And like, and what we've done differently on Night in the Attic is really think about, you know, what is the well-defined plan of the mechanics that we have, and what's the game structure. Like, we thought about that stuff really laboriously. What are our puzzles? What are our, what are our tools, our toys that you can interact with? And then like, what are a few ideas that we can use with them? And what's the sort of flow of that? And then from there, you know, went headlong into creating everything. And I think that really shows in the cohesiveness of the game and the ease that we had building it. I will be perfectly honest with you. It was an easier ride than BitCon.
Oh, really? How so? Yeah.
I just mean like it's this planning part, right? Mm. Like, I hate to say it, ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, right? So like the amount of time we spent kind of really thinking like, okay, what are our, you know, 20 different interactables that we want to use, and okay, like, how much do they all cost to make, and how do we pare them down to like the, you know, the core few that like are really, we can get the most out of, we can come up with the most ideas for, and they're the easiest to make, and they are fun. Those kind of like multiple vectors of thought process, like really thinking about that before we sat down to put pen to paper, so to speak, is very different from Big Con, because Big Con we dove in a little bit head first on some stuff. We weren't ready to do everything that we did, and we had to kind of make up time later.
That's interesting, because you know, the things when I was playing, because I played both, and when I was playing A Night in the Attic, the thing that struck me so much was the fact that, you know, you have two spaces that you're playing in. You're playing in the attic, and, you know, and I'm thinking from like a design standpoint, like there's got to be, you know, areas that are going to be colliders. You have to be careful. You can't go past this area. You can't, you know, and be able to interact with this thing, but can't interact with this thing. And then you also have like another level inside that, which is the wooden box. In that wooden box, the character, you know, like the world goes beyond just the world box. Like, you know, you go keep rolling your character forward, and it opens up the new area that you're interacting with. To me, I mean, that just blew my mind to think through like the level design around that. Like, I got to design the world that I'm in VR, but then also the character and the interaction, the little marble character of Guinevere too. That was fascinating to me.
Oh, I'm super glad that clicked. No, the team did, again, just like a lot of real iteration on what that space is and what it means to be in that space. And when we, you know, when we find elements in the sort of marble board world, like where do they go? How do you interact with them again? Like, you can kind of, you know, you can kind of mentally frame it like the tools that you find in the board are the tools in your inventory, and they're used to solve puzzles on the board. And it's like any other, you know, you can think about it like, like an adventure game where you have tools, but you're just standing in the inventory box. Mm. You know, like you're out here in the world, and the stuff that you're interacting with is within. That's again why I think it's interesting and a bit strange.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, even now that you said that, like the windmill mechanic, right? Where you're taking the windmill, it's like, I don't know, this to me just so fascinating that it's outside of the box, and yeah, I'm interacting with the box. I just thought that was so cool.
I love that, and honestly, like I'll say it was an easier general development, but figuring that stuff out is not because the way that the level is built, there's a scene somewhere else, you know, there's a little world, and we're showing you that camera through the board, but having the wind kind of blow from the attic into that world is a very strange and magical thing.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I think if I asked how it worked, I think it would ruin the magic for me. So I will never ask the team how that works. I'm just going to keep it a secret for myself.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. I absolutely loved that. And when I was playing it, I was thinking through like, how did this work? How did you design this? Like, it's just so fascinating. So,
yeah, it means a lot to just hear that. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Well, thank you for making such an awesome game. The other thing that I wanted to ask about was, because these are, you know, a lot of puzzles, right? And you're thinking through the puzzles, what came first, the idea behind creating like a labyrinth type game, and then creating puzzles in that? Or did you have a story first and then say, hey, how can we take the story and apply it to like a puzzle?
100%. It was like puzzles first.
Okay.
You know, ideas and puzzles kind of coming first. And like the story is a great way to frame what you're doing and kind of give context and motivation. But you know, because we were doing this real big focus on comfort and approachability and stress-free play, like we really wanted to think what that felt like before we knew what the story was. Mm. And then, I mean, once you know what that story is, and some of your interactions sort of are informed by the story, right? But but for the most part, you know, it's starting with like, okay, what can we, because I mean, the story itself, like every layer of the story we've already talked about, really like it wasn't around for the first like 6 months of development, 8 months of development. So, you know, we had a different kind of setting. It wasn't in an attic. Like but what we knew was important was like, okay, well, we need a windmill, you know, like we need the water jug. We need these things that are cool. Like how do we make interesting gameplay with those things first? And then, you know, what the story team does, what our art director does, is make those things beautiful and fit in with the world after the fact.
Nice. Speaking of which, then with the design too, one of the things I loved about A Night in the Attic is the fact that you do scaffolding of learning. So like, for instance, you learn how to use a tool one way, but then the players will apply it a different way. How challenging was that to build a game where you show, you know, like a piece of the, like you have a like a layer of learning, but then you want them to build off of that learning and continue to build their skills with those tools?
I mean, the difficulty really depends on the scope of what you're trying to do, but like, it helps a lot if you are setting up these puzzles around, you know, specific mechanics. Mm-hmm. And these are our thoughts of George, one of our creative directors, and he did all the level design, on this, but you know, he says that like, he was thinking very by the book when it comes to this kind of thing. Introduce a mechanic, give a safe area to practice the mechanic, give a harder difficulty on the mechanic, and then give a twist on the mechanic. And like, that is a formula, that is a way of thinking and working that really works for games. Again, like by going with what works, we can really lean into our approachability, because we know that people can approach that and grow with the challenge. you know, as we lay it out for them, as we scaffold it. I love that word. Thank you, by the way. But like, once you kind of set up the structure for the mechanic, you can mess around with it, but keeping that flow of like growing a little harder, a little bit of a twist, relearning it. It means that, you are building on things rather than just relying on, or in some cases with games that I've seen, forgetting about, you know, mechanics. Sometimes you're like, oh, the level designer who, you know, has been me sometimes, like, oh, we didn't do a ground pound in a while, let's do a ground pound. like that kind of thing, right? Yes. I think it results in a really, you know, fresh and interesting approach, even though it is a formula, because it makes you like, the challenge is to work within that. What's the harder challenge? What's the twist? What's the really hard challenge? Like, the challenge is to use a structure, but come up with innovative ways to challenge yourself in designing new things.
Yeah, I love that. And what I love about that too is, as a player, it feels like, oh, I solved that. I figured that out. Even though, like, I know the designer is like, no, we designed it the way we wanted you to figure that out. But it feels like, from a player perspective, right, that you feel like you solved something and you accomplished something that was beyond what you were showing.
There's a level in Mystic Forest, so like the second kind of area of the game, which I don't think, you know, we call it Mystic Forest. I don't know that we've ever actually surfaced those world names at all. We call it Mystic Forest. So that's a little insider information for the podcast. But there's a level in it with these sort of like perspective or like space bending elements. And every time I solve one, I'm like, I'm a genius.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Oh, I did it. I did the thing. And I've done it like six times and I forget every time. And I go back in and I'm like, oh, I'm a genius.
Yes.
Which again, I think is just credit to the level design.
Yeah. Yeah. That is one of the moments that I felt like, oh wow, I figured that out. Yeah, that was me. The other one, and I know this is probably not as like aha moments, but for me, I was like, oh, that pitcher of water, if I pour it on the lava, oh, look at that, I'm building a path for Gwen. Yeah, I figured that out. Like,
that's a fun one, right? And then, you know, like, you can feel really cool, but then there's also some off path stuff where you can like kind of sneak around and, you know, like you can pour some rocks for Gwen and play with that mechanic a little bit too, which I think is fun.
Well, that's fun. Yeah, I love that. Speaking of the level design then too, and the toys aspect of it, how challenging was it to create levels in a way that felt like you're playing with a toy? And then besides the wooden labyrinth, because that's obviously a huge influence. In fact, that's another moment where there's like some scaffolding of learning, right? Where you learn the labyrinth playing and then it rolls into the game. Were there other toys that influenced the game design as well?
I mean, in a way that it's like the simple machininess of, you know, a windmill, a crank, there are elements that I think are, you know, hitting something with a hammer. Like, I think everything about this game is about sort of playing with and tinkering with it in a way that I think feels very childish. Like, I think you know, but that wasn't necessarily what we were going for. Like, we were aiming for kind of like fun, not stressful interactions. But those in this case really ended up with that like Fisher Price banging on a big plastic thing, you know, like that is something that is enjoyable to do. And that wasn't like at any point we weren't like, we have to make this feel like a Fisher Price play place or whatever. It was actually kind of more, you know, we would design a puzzle and think about how it works and how it feels to do that. And the frame of the board and like our art director's choices about what that space is, like what the puzzle elements are in the world that you're holding in your hands, and what the bigger space is, and how the mallet looks and all that stuff. Like, I think is kind of contributing to this feeling like a toy, but ultimately, like, No, we were, I think, you know, we were building the toy, or rather using the labyrinth as a starting point meant that everything that that came from it would be, you know, by mere virtue, toy-like.
Mm. Yeah, I like that. I also love the fact that, like, when you pick up Gwen, it's like you're picking up a toy, right? And then you put her back down on the board. It just feels like you're, you know, playing with toys. I love that so much about the game.
That's, I mean, it really lent itself to the, like, the experience that we wanted to have. I'm really happy that we have that experience. A big thing for me, and it came a little later in development, but we had, like, the ability to rotate the board with the triggers.
Yeah.
Was when we did that, I was like, I it was when I started kind of holding the board up to my face and being like, oh, like, what's behind here? Like, you know, like doing, like, I'm holding a thing that's really, really cool. There's a moment at the end of the first level where we sort of teach you, like, you have to go up this hill, but, like, to do it safely, you should rotate the board. And that makes you kind of think about your position. And you can also, like, just, you know, remove the board with your hands and stuff like that. Like, yeah. I think that's really enjoyable.
Yeah. I think one of the pieces that I really loved was when you get to the castle and there's moments where she goes underneath the castle. So I'm, like, lifting up the board and I'm looking underneath it. And I'm like, you know, I loved that because it was just, it added a whole different dimension to it as well. Yeah. And it was just so cool.
See, and these are moments where, like, art direction and the fact that we acknowledge that it's a toy influences sort of, like, what looks cool from a level perspective. Like, we're like, oh, wouldn't it be neat if you had to hold the board up and like, you know, maybe hold it close to your face and stuff like that. Like, I think that's, it's the magic of video games is that, like, you know, nothing, I don't think really anything kind of comes in one direction. Like, everything is cycled around and people, you know, share different ideas and you end up kind of getting different influences on every little gameplay element. And I think that's what's really cool about it.
Yeah. What's next for Mighty Yell?
Oh gosh.
fighting game, perhaps? I'm kidding.
Yeah. Fighting game. Yeah. this, you know, I don't want to be the millionth person to answer this question this way, but, like, just, like, secret things.
Yeah.
I will say that we are going to continue committing to making some, you know, some games that don't rely on violence as a core mechanic.
Nice.
That is something that is important to us. Until I have to make the fighting game to make the bills, and then all bets are off. But, you know, we wrapped a prototype on something really cool recently, and we do have another game in the works that hopefully we'll be able to start talking about next year. Wow. But it's a little ways off before we get it to, like, really shimmer.
Wow. That amazes me because, like, the big con, that wasn't that long ago. And then,
I know.
And then this game, like, it boggles my mind. And we had a pandemic in between all of that. Like, that's so crazy.
Yeah, we started working on the big con before the pandemic and we shipped it during. And there was, like, our producer started working here 3 years ago. So, like, right at the beginning of the pandemic. Uh-huh. And he came to, like, the barbecue and met people on the team for the first time. Like, it's just ridiculous. I work hard to make sure that the team is well taken care of and that we always have something to do. And usually that results in, like, some pretty cool opportunities and, you know, I would love to launch something every year. It might not happen, but yeah. That's a pretty cool goal.
That is a very cool goal. Wow. Yeah.
Even if it's, like, a port, like we did the Switch port of Big Con after, you know, the next year after Xbox and stuff. So, you know, who knows where Night in the Attic will end up next year.
Yeah. That's awesome. How can people follow you and follow Mighty Yell?
You can find me. I am at blank Dave on Twitter. If you are still using Twitter, I still am for some reason.
Me too. I don't know why.
I'm there for the chaos, I think, at this point. I do think I'm like hate watching Twitter like a bad TV show. Because it's very similar to, it's very like the every day that I wake up where I have to hear Elon Musk's name, I'm upset. and that's just still happening. So, but you can find me. I'm at Blank Dave. I like to, talk about video games and nerd out about stuff. You can also follow our, company accounts. If you want to know about Mighty L, we always do contests and giveaways, and we got a really dope Discord. You can find it. We're at Mighty L everywhere. So even on TikTok, which our community manager, Shannon, is killing, and it's not for me. I tried really hard to get on TikTok. She's making amazing content that you should go watch. I don't understand TikTok, which is like the rally cry of people my age, of people who around.
Yes.
People who were around when shareware was a thing. You either lived during shareware or you like TikTok.
That's
and
right.
It's neither. It's one or the other.
Yep. There's no in between. Oh, I love it. Well, Dave, thank you so much. This was such a wonderful chat. And
oh, Roger, thank you.
Yeah. And I love the game. Listeners, if you haven't played it, it's on the MetaQuest 2 and 1, right? MetaQuest 1 and 2, I think.
Yeah, we also are on 1. And we are on, if you want to get that through Steam for some reason and play it on your Quest through Steam, you can do that. But yes. We are Quest ready. Get on there, write us a review. It helps a lot.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Dave, so much for joining me.
Thank you, and hope to talk soon.
Yes.